Good afternoon, and thank you for standing by. All participants will be able to listen only until the question and answer session. This conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the call over to Dr. Heidi Begovic. Ma'am, you may begin.
Thank you, Teddy. Good afternoon. Today's conference call is disaster and CDC operation. I am glad to present a speaker for today's call, Dr. Dana Bass. Dr. Bass has been a medical officer working in the areas of disaster epidemiology and health assessment at the CDC since 1996. She is presently acting team leader of the Disaster Epidemiology and Assessment Team, Health Studies Branch, National Center for Environmental Health at the CDC. The Disaster Epidemiology and Assessment Team offers technical assistance, disaster preparedness training, and consultative services to international, national, state, and local governments and agencies. PowerPoint slides for today's presentation you can find on our COCA website, www.bt.cdc.gov/coca/callinfo.asap. Dr. Beth, you may start. Thank you.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. I hope everyone can hear me well. I will try to remember to say next slide, although that's a bit of a challenge for me, but you have everything in front of you that I'm going to refer to, and feel free to peruse it at your leisure. I'm just going to kind of go through the slides because I know we have a limited amount of time, and I do want to leave some time for you all to ask questions if you have any. So if you go to the next slide on session objectives, I'm going to review some basic types of disasters and talk a little bit about potential public health impacts, give you a general overview, really, of the procedures for federal and government involvement and response to disasters. Then I'll spend a little bit of time talking about how it operates at CDC through our emergency operations system. And then I'm going to give you a couple of specific examples of some responses that occurred within the last couple of years. Next slide. I always like to start with some basic definitions as far as what is an emergency. A lot of times we use the term disaster emergency events interchangeably, and they are subtle differences. The Webster Dictionary defines an emergency as an unexpected serious occurrence or situation urgently requiring prompt attention. And you see there's several different photos of different types of emergencies there. In-house fire. That middle photo is from Banda Aceh, Indonesia, right after the tsunami in 2005. Next slide. The idea of is a disaster. There's three different terms that we generally use when we're referring to a disaster event. The first is a hazard, and that's not the disaster in itself. It's just the factors, the event that can cause a disaster. That next term, emergency, as I mentioned before with the definition, is just an event that requires immediate response. We use the term disaster primarily when we're talking about an event that overwhelms the affected community and that really requires outside assistance. All of these different terms and occurrences can have potential for negative human impact. Next slide. There's some photos there of different types of events, disaster types, such as the natural disasters, which is the area that I primarily get involved with. There's also technological disasters. Complex disasters or acts of terrorism are another type. Next slide. To give some examples specifically of natural events, we can categorize them a number of different ways. For me, it's usually easier to look at it as climate-related events, such as hurricanes or severe flooding or tsunamis, tornadoes, and then just extremes of weather, such as ice and cold and heat. There's also, next slide, geologic events such as volcanic eruptions, earthquakes, landslides, avalanches, things that are due to the forces of the earth movement or other incidences. Then I also listed there a couple other things that can potentially become disastrous. Some of these are slow onset events such as drought or famine, but sometimes disease outbreaks even or fires can turn into disastrous events. Next slide. Another way to categorize another different type of disaster is human-induced events. And these may be accidental, such as the technological or industrial, you know, releases, oil spills, hazardous chemical releases, issues with material shortages or transportation emergencies. And then, next slide, there are also human-induced events that are more intentional, and these we primarily focus on the different types of terrorism acts, you know, chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear, and even explosions are oftentimes terrorist acts. Next slide. A special type of disaster that we also look at in our center is complex emergencies. These are events that are usually spurred from a humanitarian crisis in a country or region or a particular facet of society, and it's most likely due to some type of internal or external conflict, and there's a breakdown in effective authority, and this requires not only outside assistance. It usually oftentimes requires international response, and it exceeds the capacity of usually any one single agency. Some of these examples are armed conflicts or wars or any time there's kind of massive displacement of people or refugee-type events. Those events are often termed complex emergencies. So that's just a brief overview of some of the different types of disasters. I always like to put this slide in as far as what is the risk, next slide, because when you look at all of these different types of events, you really still can't beat Mother Nature when you look at it from the idea of the probability and likelihood of the event occurring as well as the impact on, you know, human populations. Next slide. The public health response is one that we try to incorporate just an all-hazards approach. No matter what the event or the hazard that's causing the particular disaster, some of the techniques and strategies that we use are common. They transcend either terrorism, they transcend just natural events. There may be some differences as well, depending on if it is a natural event versus a terrorism act. The lead agency may vary. It may be FBI for a terrorist event versus FEMA for usually natural events. The size and scope of the response also may vary. The different messages that you want to communicate to the public also may vary depending on the type of event. With terrorist acts, of course, there's always issues regarding evidence and chain of custody for those type of contents. And then the psychological impact may vary depending on the type of event. But in general, we all try to look at disasters in an all-hazards approach. Next slide. I listed here what I have is priority public health issues. But when you really look at it, it's the public's expectations. Expectations that either, you know, you or I or our parents, our kids, our neighbors, friends, we all have certain expectations that really transcend disaster settings. We expect to have safe food and water. We expect to have a place that's secure and shelter from the elements. We expect to have a safe environment. We expect to have adequate health and medical and even mental health care if necessary. And then we expect some way to communicate with each other as well as those in power to find out what we need to do. What are the directions? Do we need to shelter in place? Do we need to evacuate? Those kind of issues transcend, like I said, the disaster setting, and it's just expectations that the public has. Next slide. I also like to emphasize that all disasters begin locally. Preparedness activities always start at the local level. The first responders most often in public health emergencies are astute local health care providers such as yourselves. There may not be an event that is so overt, such as a chemical release or a tornado. There may be events such as outbreaks of illnesses that have to be diagnosed and determined by local clinicians. So I always like to emphasize the fact that the local health care system is paramount, and that local preparedness is essential in all phases of the disaster. And it's not just the hospitals and trauma centers and the public health department. You have to look at the broader kind of aspect of the healthcare system as far as bringing in the private practitioners, pharmacists, nursing homes, assisted living facilities, hospices. How can you incorporate all of these different facets at the local level when you're responding to an event? There's a number of different ways. Also, I just wanted to point out that individuals, clinicians can volunteer and get involved in efforts. There's disaster medical assistance team. There's medical reserve corps. There's metropolitan medical strike teams. There's a number of different entities that local healthcare providers can get involved in the bigger federal system as well. Next slide. There are times when local and state resources are exhausted in an emergency, and at that time when outside assistance may be necessary. Slide. A rapid mobilization of resources across agencies and jurisdictional lines may look something like this diagram, where there's a bunch of confusion, basically. But the government has a number of assets, and management of them can be a challenge. And, of course, there's always issues of who's in charge and who reports to whom. But we do have mechanisms to help define how each of these agencies should interact with each other. And it is a complex endeavor, but there are mechanisms to help with that. And I wonder how many of these acronyms you all can name. I won't go through all of them, but they're all mostly federal agencies. Next slide. In order to help address some of that confusion and the challenges with coordination, we have a national response plan. And this is a plan that was developed to align federal coordination, basically of resources. And once again, you see here it's an all-hazards approach, and it's for primarily domestic incident management. It incorporates some previous plans that we had, which was the federal response plan. We also had a federal radiological emergency response plan, and we had a terrorism response plan. So these entities have been incorporated into the national response plan. And I'm going to spend a couple of slides going through this because I think it's important for everyone to kind of know, because this is the key entity that federal agencies work under. It's the key structure that we work under during an emergency. Next slide. The National Response Plan was signed by 29 federal agencies, including some non-governmental agencies and volunteer agencies, such as the American Red Cross, which has a key role in the National Response Plan. The all-hazards approach, it was based on the Stafford Disaster and Relief Emergency Assistance Act, and as you can see there, initially it was adopted in 1992, but most recently, December 2004, the federal response plan was replaced by the national response plan. And it's all organized under an incident command system structure, as well as the National Incident Management System, which is, I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with that, but it's based on fire department services, and it's a way to organize a response where you have an incident commander, you have a planning component, logistics component, operations component, and then finance components. In addition, there are liaison officers, safety officers, and public information officers. And the whole purpose of it is that there's one incident command system, and it's a structure that can be modified for the situation. It's flexible. It can either be expanded or collapsed based on need. Next slide. The National Response Plan usually correlates with the state as well as local plans. Most of them take on the same type of planning structure with the emergency support functions. And there's 15 of those, and there's a designated lead agency as well as support agencies for the 15 emergency support functions. The components of the plan itself, there's a base plan that describes the structure and the process. There's appendices, and then there's support annexes that go more into the individual emergency functions. And then there's also special indices, which is the fourth component for special hazard situations, such as a chem event or a radiation event. There's certain incident annexes that address those specific type of issues. Next slide. And as you can see here, it's pretty complex structure, but these are the 15 emergency support functions, and they these are things that you would think that need to be addressed during any type of emergency event. Things from transportation and communication to energy, public safety, agricultural, and as you can see there, I've listed the lead agency for each of those functions. The one that's near and dear to my heart, of course, is EAS-8, which is the Public Health and Medical Services function, and the Department of Health and Human Services is the lead agency for that particular ESF at the federal level. Next slide. And I just wanted to go a little bit more into ESF-8 so you can get an idea of what it addresses. And this is coordinated by the Secretary of Health and Human Services, which is currently Michael Levitt, and there's an Assistant Secretary for Public Health and Emergency Preparedness. There are 18 core functions that this particular support function is supposed to address. And as you can see there, they're numerous. The ones that I have italicized are the ones that CDC primarily is the lead agency for. For example, surveillance, medical equipment supplies through the stockpile. We also are the lead for worker health and safety, which is on the next slide, and that's through NIOSH. Our risk communicators and public health information is also key for us. Vector control is also one of our things that fall in our domain, and also some of the water and wastewater issues we share with the Indian Health Service. But if you look at all of these 18 functions, pretty much anything that would relate to health or medical services is covered, anywhere from patient care and evacuation, personnel issues, mortuary services, animal health. It's really a comprehensive way to look at health and medical services. Next slide. The way a mission is assigned during a federally declared disaster, and the governor is the person who declares the disaster and then asks for assistance from the president. Once the local health needs are identified, once again, all disasters are locally. The local emergency management agency tries to address the issues and assess the situation. Then if it goes beyond their capacity at the time, because most times, of course, the locals are affected themselves, you know, personally, when any event occurs in their area, it may move then to the state emergency management agency or the state health agencies. At that stage, sometimes states can go from state to state just to try to get mutual aid, or there's a program called EMAC, which is Emergency Management Assistance Contact, where another state can request a particular type of resources from another state. Those type of mechanisms can be engaged, and then if it still goes beyond the local and the state level, they can then ask for assistance at the federal level, and FEMA, for especially natural events, is the lead agency for that. FEMA then would get the request that there's an identified need, and if it's an event that falls under Health and Medical Services, which is ESF-8, then they would route that request to DHHS, which is the lead agency for that emergency support function. There's a whole lot of steps in between there, but once the mission is assigned to DHHS, if you look at the next slide, DHHS has a number of different agencies, along with CDC, that can be mobilized during an emergency. I think the majority, however, of requests during at least a natural event do come out of from HHS, usually come to CDC. But any of these other agencies get involved as well. Indian Health Service, SAMHSA, ATSDR, which is CDC sister agency. So HHS can pull upon any of these agencies to carry out those ESF-8 functions. Next slide. I just wanted to put on here the vision and mission statement for our emergency preparedness at CDC. And I think the mission is important because it incorporates our general business, such as preventing death, disability, and disease and injury, and that's at all times, but it relates it to the urgent health threats. And also, as far as our role in improving preparedness, not only of the public health system, but also of the healthcare, the medical delivery system, as well as the general public. And our forte, of course, is to utilize science as well as provide services in these areas to the states and our contributaries.
All right.
When you look at the emergency response resources that CDC, ATSDR has, there are a number, and I kind of categorize them here into these three main areas, although there's a number of different ways to categorize our assets. But the first bullet there is the Strategic National Stockpile, and it's a natural catch of medical supplies and pharmaceuticals needed for response to public health and weapons of mass destruction emergencies. It's designed to supplement the local supplies and resupply state and local public health agencies in the event of a national emergency within the U.S. and its territories. Some of you may be familiar, but they have these push packages that are available to the states and are supposed to be able to be delivered anywhere in the country within 12 hours upon the decision to deploy that asset. The third bullet there, I'll jump a little, is the specialized laboratory support. CDC has a number of labs in our infectious disease as well as our environmental health center, and primarily we do biological specimens, blood, urine, could be sometimes they do hair, nails, other biological specimens, to help states identify agents or help assist with exposure. And then the middle bullet there is, I think, what we most often, especially from my side of things, get involved with is technical consultation and expertise. We can provide surge capacity to the states that they need, EPI assistance. We have a number of different specialties and subject matter experts and advisors that are available at CDC to the states and whoever else requests. We have specialized risk communicators. There's environmental health specialists. We have worker health and safety specialists, et cetera. So there's a number of different functions that CDC can carry out based on the state's needs. Next slide. The initiation point for CDC during an emergency is the Director's Emergency Operations Center, the DEOC. It's a central point for monitoring the agency's involvement in public health events, and that's all public health emergency events, disasters, outbreaks, et cetera. They work in concert with our centers who are responding to the disaster. For example, in natural disasters, the Center for Environmental Health, my center, is the lead. If it's pandemic flu or something like that, the Infectious Disease Center would be the lead. And during an emergency, it's really your lifeline to CDC. And I've listed the number there. It's a 24-hour number, and you can contact them at any time for questions or any needs that you have. Next slide. The CDC, once we are activated, as far as there's a request out of HHS for assistance from our agencies, we have emergency response coordinators who are experienced in not only what CDC has to offer, but they also have some experience usually with local as well as various state health programs. And they're there to support the states and to be a coordinating body between CDC, like a liaison, between CDC and the states, and then they're also there to support any local responders who may be requested for particular activities or functions within state. So they're kind of a linkage. We also now have what they're calling senior management officials, and they're not in all the states, so there are plans for them to be in a number of different states. I know we have them in most of the hurricanes from last year affected states like Florida, Louisiana and Arkansas, and this person is a full-time person who sits with the state and is there to kind of be that liaison between CDC and the state, not only in disaster events, but even in regular business events, just normal business events. If the emergency response coordinators, once they have arrived and done their kind of initial assessment of the event, they may ask for additional support through a preliminary assessment team, which is a multidisciplinary team. It could be a risk communicator, emergency responder, a disaster physician, an EPI, a lab person, depending on what the needs of the situation require. And then that preliminary assessment team can normally will go out and make an initial assessment, and then once again try to match what CDC has to offer with what the state needs. And it's just an on-ground set of eyes and hands and ears to assess the situation. Next slide.